Welcome to Therabytes, where we bring you bite-sized episodes, each one a piece of the puzzle that helps to explain the therapy world, the research behind it all, and how it relates to families. Hello, my name is Dr. Dana Poole. I'm a physiotherapist and a clinical lead at the Healthy Strides Foundation. It is my privilege to be hosting this podcast, one that is directed for parents of children with neurodisabilities. We hope to be able to answer some of your questions through this format. But to navigate our way through these big questions, we have the one and only, the lovely Nareesha co-hosting this podcast. Welcome, Nareesha.
Hi, Dana. How are you this morning?
I'm very well today.
The weather's great.
Weather's great. Going to have a great conversation.
Yes, we are. I'm hoping so.
It's a good way to start the podcast.
Am? Yeah.
Well, before we get into yet another question that you have for me, as we all know, I love to be able to share all this new research that keeps coming out. So did you know that when we have this sensation that's called groove, particular rhythms actually do trigger a higher desire to move? And it's actually because it's mirrored in our brains, particularly the left sensory motor cortex. So there's this real relationship between action and sensory processes. So if you find that you cannot help but to tap along to some music, it's actually because there's a scientific explanation for it. It's connected to our brain.
Who would have thought?
Who would have thought, right?
So, and like, I'm so learning that all these things that are random is all connected to our brain.
I know. The more we understand the brain, the better. It can be a little bit alarming sometimes. Yeah. Every time I mix my sweet and savory, I think about how it's not my fault. There's actually just a connection that makes me want to eat it.
True.
And now when I'm sitting along and I'm just grooving along, well, these researchers who publish in Science Advances just last month actually have shown that there is this thing. But the only thing I have to ask about that though is what happens to people who've got no sense of rhythm?
Oh, you can tell by the way they dance.
The Elaine Bennis of Seinfeld. Exactly. Yeah, they can't quite dance, but they can't do anything in time. So what does that mean about that connection?
They're not in sync, right?
Yeah. So anyway, maybe that will be some future research. But if you do find yourself nodding away, tapping away, you can't help it. There is a scientific explanation that makes you want to do it.
That's right. Mm. There's no other better excuse than that.
I know, right? My brain's telling me to
do
it.
So I can keep dancing, grooving, music, driving. Perfect.
It's always fun when you sing along and you look next door to you as you're driving.
Somebody's
you're
looking
like,
at you.
I can't help it. The music's making me do it. My left sensory motor cortex, in fact. There we go.
Make it scientific.
All right. Well, now that we've covered off some research that I just was dying to share, Nareesha, what is your question for me today?
All right. On a serious note, one that I've got is no pain and no gain.
Oh.
Right. So, I mean, how far do we push through pain to have an outcome?
That's a really good question. Right. Wow, that got serious really quickly, but I think it's a really important thing to think about. Yeah. So no pain, no gain. I think we're so used to hearing things like that, right? It might be, I don't know, high school gym class. If you're going to run, run hard.
Yeah.
And you're not going to get any better unless there's some pain. And or any sort of high-level sports elite, yes, you do get some muscle soreness. And it's widely accepted that if you get, you know, well, we know that if you get muscle soreness, you're going to gain some strength.
Yeah.
So I think that's probably where it came from.
Yeah. But I mean, I can understand it from a, you know, an adult's point of view.
Pushing hard.
Yeah. Yep. And then obviously we know the repercussions of pushing hard.
Yes.
So it has to be regular movement, not once in a blue moon like me. So
it's the injury that happens if you push yourself too hard.
Yeah,
so
that's
we know
right.
The
that's
other
the main
side
concern, correct?
Yeah. Yep.
So then it brings up, obviously, I've been... Well, to be honest, I went through my little boy's history of therapy. Mm-hmm. In previous podcasts, I've stipulated that he's a child with cerebral palsy. So anyway, I was just looking through, being melancholic is the word I think it was, going back through time, seeing his progression, going through all the different therapies that we utilized through his journey. Now, it's amazing how far he's come.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And
so worth celebrating.
Observing that he always smiled, always enjoyed himself. Mm-hmm. But then I came through something and it popped up. Mm-hmm. And it left me a little bit distressed in the fact that, I mean, obviously I'm aware that there are different methods of doing therapy.
Yes.
And so this particular therapy that I was distraught about was the way they were handling the child. Mm-hmm. We take our children to a health specialist, yep. knowing that when we leave it in their care, that they're being looked after, providing the therapy that doesn't put them through any strain or any pain or any post-therapy issues.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, how does that happen?
Yeah.
I guess is the question.
Gosh, there's a big questions and lots to reflect on there. And it's a really worthy thing to talk about because I think it's often really unsaid.
Mm.
So let's go back to the fact that sometimes we think no pain, no gain.
Yeah.
I want to say categorically, there is nowhere in therapy land for children with neurodisabilities where that would ever be true. It is completely something we should throw away. No pain, no gain is dangerous.
Right.
We're talking about children. Not only that, we're talking about children who have different sensory experiences. Mm. We're talking about children who might communicate in different ways, whether they can communicate fast enough. We know that some children will take a little bit longer to respond.
Yeah, correct.
And we know that when a child, by the time a child is crying, it might have gone too far.
Yep.
For children who can't communicate, crying is the only thing that they have to get your attention, you know, when you're coming back down to the basics. So first of all, when it comes to respecting a child's experience and to learn, no pain, no gain has no place. And if you are crying during sessions, during therapy, we also know that you're not learning anything. Because when you're crying, you release cortisol.
That's right? The one I was just going to ask.
Yeah. So cortisol, we all know by now, it's a stress hormone. It gets released when we're upset. We all have it.
Yeah.
And think to a time when you're feeling really overwhelmed and you're really stressed.
Mm.
If someone tries to have a conversation with you, it's like in one ear, out the other.
Correct.
You can't concentrate, and there's a physiological reason why. It's just like some music makes us bop along. Mm. It makes us do it.
Yeah.
When this hormone gets released, you're not actually in that space anymore. So your short-term memory gets affected, and it disrupts the process of neuroplasticity, which is the reason why you originally wanted to go to therapy in the first place, is to learn a new skill. So if you're crying, you're completely disrupting that process.
Yeah.
So from a human rights perspective, from a pain perspective and how that's related, and from the perspective of learning a new skill, being in pain, being upset, being in stress has no place for our children.
And being a child.
And being a child,
It brings me back to a time when I was actually in hospital. I'm not sure whether I was visiting. But you know how parents, you know, when they're so happy with babies and they try and like hold their baby up and just like moving them up and down in their arms? I remember a nurse actually interceded and she said, look, babies are so precious. They're still so young.
Yes.
Shaking them like that is not a good idea.
Mm.
So that's from a baby's point of view. And then we're talking about, what, 2-3-year-olds being handled in such a stressful way.
Yeah.
And their body's in pain anyway, constant pain, right? Doesn't make sense, right?
Yeah, that's true. And that's a good point. So we do know that a lot of our children, particularly with cerebral palsy, when there's a physical condition, when you have spasticity or dystonia, we know that children do experience pain.
Yeah.
And we know that's probably really underreported because really young children might not be able to report that just yet because we know that, you know, like we've all had cramps in the middle of the night.
Oh, definitely.
and you jump up, but we have the ability to stretch it out and seek an intervention for that to help us. But a lot of our children don't get to do that. So there's just underlying discomfort that they might be experiencing.
Mm-hmm.
They also talk about children who are under 2 have this neuroirritability. And I think parents might know what that looks like in our children where they just look really frustrated. They're crying for
tantrum.
It doesn't seem like a good reason. Yeah, it's just, exactly.
Tantrum
just
crying.
Neuroirritability.
Right.
We have this level of discomfort.
Okay.
So if we're adding on something that we know isn't really working and the child is making them more distressed, there is no place for that. And that's why we do need to take a step back and a parent's instinct to go, this doesn't look right.
Mm.
It's a right instinct. We've talked about this intervention before. It's a lot of handling. You'll see it online, holding them at their ankles and you're flipping them around, you're flopping their head around.
Yeah.
You know, it looks confronting and it is confronting.
Mm.
And it's based on, you know, really outdated science. That's number one, because it's based on reflexes. It's really outdated. But the second part of it is the safety. And yeah. we've spoken about this a little bit before. A treatment's effective when it produces a good outcome that we can measure and it makes a difference
yep.
in their life.
Yeah, yeah.
But a treatment is also a good treatment if it doesn't cause any harm.
Mm.
And when it comes to pain,
that should be
kids,
a number one priority.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Protecting your child. So it's a really important topic to talk about because I think sometimes we just feel like we just have to push through. And my message is always, you don't have to push through. Children should be happy. And, you know, even if a session looks like they're having a whole lot of fun, I've said this before, fun just means we're enjoying the journey.
Yeah,
it doesn't
that's right.
It doesn't mean they're not doing anything.
Mm.
And for children, what's their main occupation?
It's to have fun.
It's have fun. It's brilliant. We all need a little bit more of that.
And they'll come again running. So I guess my next question would be, with this type of therapy that's out there,
mm-hmm.
I mean, that's obviously an alternate therapy.
Mm-hmm.
Has there been any successful stories? I mean, whether it be short term or long term?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So look, the main thing to say about this intervention, let's label it, let's call it, it's called dynamic movement intervention. There's a lot of it you'll see online on
right.
stories.
Okay.
That's actually based on a technique that was developed, invented back in the 1970s. That was called CME.
Okay.
So they're all kind of the same thing. And there's been a few case studies that have been published on one child.
Right.
Nothing that's high quality where you can go, actually, this makes a difference or doesn't make a difference.
Oh, okay.
It's only been done in one child. And the danger of that is whilst they reported that there were some improvements, it wasn't done on a measure that we know is a reliable measure. It
okay.
was kind of a measure that they've sort of made up.
Oh, right.
And the other part of it was measured during a time where children naturally develop and grow. So the danger of case studies of one single story is that you've never compared it to a child's natural progression.
Right.
We've spoken about this before where we know that children do actually develop. They do, regardless of our therapy. But if you just do a case study and you apply the intervention with not a good measure that is, you know, gold standard, that child could have been developing and growing anyway.
Yeah.
So was that intervention even effective? And so I would say the same thing to all the things you do see on social media. It's very compelling. Like the music's very evocative.
Yeah.
They're testimonials, which is in Australia is we're not allowed to do testimonials because you're showing the story of one person and you're trying to imply that anyone can have the same result.
Right.
And the reason why we do research is that we try to separate it. We go, okay, does this intervention actually make more of a difference? Then no intervention at all.
Yeah.
And there needs to be research on it. If we're going to look at it in a really serious way, there needs to be research on it.
Yeah.
And there hasn't been good quality research that's done. So
okay.
be careful of stories because you don't know the child's history.
Yeah.
You don't know what they've, you know, what their cognition is like, their hearing is like, their vision is like. Do they have seizures? Do they have any other features that make them respond in a particular way?
Yeah, yeah.
And how old are they? Are they developing anyway? Is that what's actually happening? And a really, really good anecdote is Egmar Longo. This is this professor in Brazil, as well as we call her ACDC, Ana Carolina de Campos.
Oh.
But, well, I'm calling her ACDC.
Wow. Yep.
These are great researchers in Brazil. And they've just said, look, there's given the current state, it's just time to abandon them. There's better stuff around.
Yep.
And Egmar Longo talks about like a dance. So if you're dancing along to a particular rhythm, it's like evidence. When the music changes, you change.
Right.
So,
okay.
You know, this might have been something we thought about in the 1970s that was like an idea.
Yeah.
But things have moved along. So, you know, we don't take it personally. The music changes. We just keep changing with the music.
Keep up with the time.
That's right. And, you know, and nowadays, kids these days do all that, you know, sort of music. And that's that rhythm that helps them to flow. But we should always be keeping up with the times. And, yeah, my main message for that is just be really careful. You'll see really provocative things on online.
Okay.
And there's stories of one child.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean it's effective. And it doesn't mean that there's been research on it either because anyone can post.
Yeah, that's true.
Right? That's the problem.
On that note, I guess a few tips that I think that maybe parents should consider.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, do research on the therapy that they're going to.
Yeah.
Be present at their child's therapy.
Yeah.
Just
good
so
one.
That you're observing what's going on. And listen to the signs of your child.
Yeah.
You should know as a parent what's hurting them and what's not.
Yeah. Yeah.
What do you reckon?
I think so. I think your instincts as a parent is actually something that's so valuable.
Yeah.
And you know your child so well. You know their little signs. You know if they're uncomfortable, if they're upset, follow those instincts and just ask questions of your therapist.
Sounds good.
We've got nothing to hide. There's nothing that we'll be offended about when you ask us those questions. So, yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
Oh, that was our big one.
Eye opener.
Yeah, that was a good one. But thank you for asking the question. It's great to be able to talk about it. So I'll look forward to your next question next week. Talk to you all again really soon. All bye, right. Everyone.
Bye.